We are giving away limited edition Unsolved Mysteries Rewind tinfoil hats on our Facebook group. Head on over to find out how you can receive one of these amazing kits for free. Or you can email us at unsolvedmysteriesrewind@gmail.com.
We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Kim, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you?
I'm good, Kim. How are you doing?
Oh, I am great. I am excited to jump into this. They don't know out there in podcast land, but you and I have taken a slight little break, and I'm just ready to get back on track.
It's weird, because we've been so consistently recording, and we delayed this one for, what, 4 days? But it feels like we haven't recorded in weeks.
I feel like I haven't talked to you in a month and a half.
Right. It's like we're our own support group here.
I'm
glad that we jumped right back into it. And this one starts with a little bit of history that
is
a little off my radar. I don't know why. I don't know much about this period of time. But Dutch Schultz is one of those names that I guess you really kind of put right next to all the other mob bosses of the 1920s. I guess Al Capone and...
Yeah.
No one else. I don't know.
Lucky Luciano. Let's see, George Nelson. But before we get to that, I just want to say we're talking about season 6, episode 20.
Yes. From 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is interesting because there's also there's a lot of reenactment in this particular episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was living for the first one with the Dutch Schultz treasure. So I got a lot of this information from a website called babyfacenelsonjournal.com. But just a heads up, if you go to that website, you are going to see some dead bodies. I was pretty surprised.
Yeah, and they usually put them right next to a living version of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'll be because we get into it later in the story about his last words. So they had like verbatim his last words because there was a court stenographer there.
And that's crazy.
It was crazy. But I read like every single last word and just scrolling down. And then there would just be like 5 pictures of his dead body. I was like, ooh, okay.
But yeah, like you really experienced it. That's wild.
Ooh, it was guttural. So Dutch Schultz, he is a mob boss in New York in the 1920s. And in the 1935, he and his henchman, Bernard Lulu Rosencrantz, they were digging along the side of the Esopus Creek in New York.
85 miles from my house.
Get a shovel and start digging because, according to legend, he buried a ton of treasure there that night. They call it on Unsolved Mysteries a king's ransom of cash, bonds, unset diamonds, and gold coins.
That is something I would love to come across.
Oh my God, you and me both. It was actually worth $7 million at the time, but now if we translate that to 2020 money, that is $131 million.
2020 money, I'll take it.
let
me just say, I want to mention that these are Jewish names. So I think that this is really the Jewish mob period. And people don't know, too often. I mean, there were mobs with all of these different minority groups back then. Now, of course, the Italians were the most popular. I would say when a stereotype is put next to a mob or a mafia. But the Jews were definitely heavily into it. I believe there was Irish. Nowadays, the Asian groups, as we spoke about in other episodes, there was also a lot of murdering going on during this time.
Families.
And I mentioned a book before, and I'm going to try to find to see if it's still published. But it's a photograph book of the person who would take a photograph of the crime scenes that would, like these hits. And it makes me feel cool to see hits. But they would have like these really tall tripods, like maybe 10 to 20 feet tall. And they would just take a complete shot of the entire area. So you'd see the legs of the tripod. And it's fascinating to look at. It's very gruesome, very dark. But the photography itself is, in a lot of ways, really beautiful because it's, you know, just that rich black and white, high resolution photography.
I would love a copy of that book. And I think that a lot of people listening would love to know the title. Do you know the title offhand?
It's a book I have on a shelf somewhere. Is that the title?
Okay, sorry. No, Put you on the spot.
I will find it. And okay. I will let you know, and I will make it public.
Okay, no pressure. So on Unsolved Mysteries, we get like a brief history of Prohibition, which was from 1920 to 1933, and it was just banning liquor consumption in America. So we get to learn about the underground liquor sales and speakeasies, and basically the mobsters would run this kind of underground operation.
Have you ever gone to one of these like speakeasies that were turned into a new bar?
No, I've never even heard of that.
All right. Well, if you ever come to New York City, and if we ever have the nerve to actually go into the city, there's what we call the 86 bar. So it's, I forget the exact address, but it's 86 and that, and there's no sign. There's no anything. You just have to know it's there and you walk in and it's an old speakeasy and it's That's super popular cool. bar. And it's a really great place. And it's all decorated with the photographs of mobsters who were there. And if you go in the bathroom area, you see like the hidden doors in 86, but I believe it was the 86 club or the 86 bar. And, have you ever heard of like where people say 86, this guy, it comes from that bar.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So it's kind of like, get out of here or get him out of here.
Well, speaking of bathrooms and speakeasies, no. So we get to meet Dutch Schultz, who was actually born Arthur Flagenheimer in 1902. And FBI guy Jack French kind of tells us about his bootlegging and his speakeasies and how he was running like an underground narcotics business. But in his career as a mobster over 10 years, he is reported to have killed 136 people.
Oh, my God.
I had sent you this information earlier just in a private message where he took this guy, kidnapped him, tied him up to meat hooks, and then wrapped his eyes with a gonorrhea-infected bandage. And this guy actually lived, but he was blind for the rest of his life.
Like, that's horrific. Just crazy. I mean, what kind of, how depraved do you have to be to come up with this?
I know. It's like, I was not expecting when we're going to learn about mobsters and stuff about like biological warfare. Like I was really surprised to hear about that. That was messed up. And how on earth do you get that?
There is a similar story that I've heard. Not with him. It could have been with him back in the late, I'm going to stop with all my stories, but back in the early, like 2000s or something, there were all of these like collectible baseball card type things. One was the collection of mobsters. And on the back of one of them, it's chilling. The person was interrogating somebody and they wrapped the person and they can only breathe through like a straw or something. And they took a huge bottle of Tabasco sauce and put it there.
Oof.
So you basically choked to death on Tabasco sauce.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like what's wrong with you? Your mom didn't like hug you enough. Like I don't understand how cruel some of these things are. But the gonorrhea gauze trumps the hot sauce thing.
Oh yeah, it is rough. So he actually is so rough and so aggressive that he is named public enemy number one by the Justice Department. They got him kind of how they got all the mobsters, where he's indicted on tax evasion.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes on the lam, and author Thomas P. Terry tells us that he was facing a very long prison sentence. So he gathers up all of his resources with the help of Lulu and Marty Crompier in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And they put all of that treasure into a steel plated strongbox. So Dutch Schultz is the only one that holds the key, and Dutch and Lulu drove from Bridgeport to Venencia?
Yeah, Venencia, yeah.
Okay, Venencia, New York, where they buried the treasure along the Esopus Creek, and they marked where the treasure was. I know.
This is the smartest thing about, this is before GPS, this is before you could geotag something.
Yeah, they just carved an X in a tree.
They put a rock next to it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was all perfect.
Not very, the smartest very... people in the world, really. Come on.
So Lulu actually blabs to Marty about where they buried the treasure, and he even drew Marty a map of where it is. And Marty blabs to, like, a blonde at the bar that he's trying to impress. Schultz surrendered to the authorities over his whole tax evasion issue in Albany, New York, and his first trial was hung. So, and he was acquitted in the second trial. Now, he is accused of jury tampering, not like officially, but it's kind of out there that he jury tampered.
Pretty common back at this time, too.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. He had actually moved. He was like, I'm not going to get a fair trial in Albany because everybody knows about this. So he moved to the small rural town of Malone, New York.
Just visited there last summer.
Yes, you did. I know you did. And he set himself up as like this benefactor of the town before his trial. So he would donate cash to businesses and hand out toys to the children in town. And that's what got him acquitted.
Is it possible he was a fan of Laura Ingalls Wilder's writings?
I mean, it's not impossible. And if you don't know what we're talking about, Malone, New York is actually the hometown of Laura Ingalls Wilder's future husband, Almanzo Wilder.
Crazy.
I know. And I am... It's so hard.
Maybe he lived next door to the horse farm that the Wilders had.
It's possible. I mean, they could have crossed paths. Who knows?
It's more than possible. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's small world sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Mayor LaGuardia was actually so outraged about this acquittal that he demanded that Dutch Schultz be immediately arrested if he ever set foot in New York City again.
That's so some, like, law. Like, I mean, how do you make a law like that?
I don't know. It's so 1800s, yes, like Deadwood style law. I don't know how you do that. So he was like, okay, I guess I'm not going to New York. So he moved his operation to Newark, New Jersey. And he owned a tavern there called the Palace Chop House. And he went on this crazy killing spree to try and regain power. He had actually spent so much money on his defense funds over these two trials that he was taking money from his underlings, and they started hating him for this, and they were leaving and they were going to other families. So his family was, like, quickly dwindling.
Now, most of this information you found out, this is not on the Unsolved Mysteries segment. The segment is really kind of a straightforward segment. It's a very light, yeah, glazing over the entire story. So I just want to add that a lot of this information you're not going to find on Unsolved Mysteries, which we love, but it definitely is it's a great place to start. But the information that Kim has dug up is definitely exclusive to this show.
As with most of what we've researched, I would say it's 60% Unsolved Mysteries, 40% what we research, yes, outside of it. So to regain power, because his family was dwindling down, he went in front of the Mafia Commission, like all the heads, and he asked them for permission to kill New York City District Attorney Thomas Dewey. Now, the other families were like, no, are you crazy? That's going to bring the police down on us hard. They were like unanimously denying your request. And he's like, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And he just kind of leaves that Mafia Commission. And they're like, we got to do something about him. So they actually decide to kill Dutch before Dutch can kill Dewey. And they... the commission actually assigns Lepke Buchalter, I'm sure I butchered that, to assassinate Dutch. So October 23rd, 1935, it's 10:15 p.m. Dutch is at his tavern, the Palace Chop House, with two of his bodyguards, Lulu and a man named Abe Landau. And he's also there with his accountant, Otto Berman. Dutch goes to the bathroom, and in walk Charles Workman and Emanuel Weiss. Now, they are under the orders of Lepke, and they had come to exact retaliation. So they walk right in the bathroom past the bodyguards, and they shot Dutch right in the bathroom.
Now,
and
this is all the early this is mid-30s, right?
Yeah, 35.
No, you know, Thomas Dewey would go on to run for president. You know, he went, mm-hmm, you know, he very powerful political person. I would say anybody who's going to run for president, whether, you know, nowadays or back then, you have to have some level of political power. And just interesting how they would want to take out this person, you know, just literally 5 years before he would attempt to get the Republican nomination.
Yep, it was him versus Truman.
It's crazy. Yeah, because Dewey, yeah. I it didn't click until just now, but it was a really pretty big campaign.
Yeah, the whole Dewey defeats Truman thing.
And he, he ran like five times or so, four times. Mm-hmm. In 40, 44, 48, and 52, and then he finally gave up after over a decade of failure.
Well, so he's safe and sound. He obviously escaped this assassination attempt. But the fact that the guys kind of walked in past the bodyguards and shot Dutch had a lot of people thinking that the bodyguards were in on it because everyone was turning on Dutch. So he's like, I am a classy guy. I am not going to die in a bathroom. So he crawls to the table and sits at the table with his hat on. I've seen the pictures. And he's just kind of sitting at the table bleeding out. So,
oh, my God.
Speaking of biological warfare, he was actually shot specifically with rust-covered bullets so that if the bullets didn't kill him, the infection would.
Now, bullets are lead, aren't they? Does lead rust?
I don't know. I don't know what they dipped it in. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm sure they had a solution to add rust to the bullet. It's just, it seems dangerous. We did discuss bullets in a previous episode, and it just seems like the kind of thing you wouldn't really want to mess with. But for all we know, it could have been like rust powder or something.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? So the guys actually, after they shoot Dutch, they go up and shoot up the rest of the bodyguards and the accountant guy. So they're mortally wounded and they both run out of the restaurant to shoot the assassins. So Landau, they just don't make them like this anymore. So
no,
Landau,
this is crazy. And everyone's like Jewish. It's crazy.
It makes me laugh so hard about this one part about how like unkillable these guys are. So it's like Rasputin levels, but Landau shoots the car a few times and he ends up collapsing on a trash can outside. And Lulu collapses in the hallway of the restaurant trying to shoot the bad guys. So Schultz is at the table and he's like, help, call me an ambulance. Anybody that can hear my voice, call me an ambulance. So Lulu, who's in the hallway, crawls over to the bar. Apparently there was a barman kind of hiding behind the bar. And he's like, say, do you have change for a quarter? And so the barman takes the quarter, gives him five nickels. Lulu's like, thank you very much, sir. And goes out around the corner to a payphone.
I'm sorry, is there a laugh track that's included with that?
Isn't it ridiculous?
Like, use the bar phone or just, I don't know. Like, the whole thing is nuts.
It begs the question, why wouldn't the barman go run out and use the payphone? Like, he was fine. He was not injured. So Lulu hobbles out to the phone booth, places a call for an ambulance before passing out in the phone booth. That's where they find him. So anyway, the ambulance comes, takes the two bodyguards first because they were the most seriously wounded. And while waiting for the second ambulance, the medics are like, oh, we don't have any medicine here. But you know what we do have? A whole lot of brandy. So they're like pouring alcohol down his throat to try and like dull his pain. Yeah, so
it'll work.
He gets, it'll do the job in a pinch, but he gets taken to the hospital. He has a fever of 106 degrees and is probably on some pretty serious pain pills and is drunk out of his mind on brandy.
Oh my God.
He just starts blabbering away. So the police are like, who shot you, Dutch? Who shot you? And he's just like, oh, I'm a pretty good pretzel, Winifred. The put up youngins, boys. And I'm not exaggerating. Those are literal quotes from what he said, because the police brought in a courtroom stenographer to write down everything that he said.
Now, back then, I just want to say about the technology that existed. Now, stenographers great and blah, blah, blah. But back then, you know, of course, they had recording equipment. Why wouldn't have this been recorded? They used to have this one recorder and it recorded on a wire. It didn't have magnetic tape. It would actually record on a thin piece of metal wire. And it was used with stenographers because stenographers, it would be basically as a backup to the stenographer. And just imagine having this recording. It would just be, you know, legendary.
Yeah, honestly, it was pretty silly. Like, I read every single word that he uttered in those hours before his death, and it was all just gobbledygook. Yeah. Like, it was crazy. And he just kept being like, oh, mama, like, he kept seeing his mom there and stuff. So he was like on the edge, because, you know, they say like when you're on the edge, you can see people on the other side. So I don't know. I never thought about the wire, but he supposedly during these ramblings begs to be taken to Phoenicia where the treasure was.
I'll buy my way out of this.
Yeah, I think he thinks he's fine. So the police are like, this guy's talking crazy. So he actually does die of peritonitis from the rust bullets. Oof. Because peritonitis is a bacterial infection of the membrane that lines your inner abdomen. Thank you, Google. But Marty,
mission accomplished on those bullets, you know.
Yeah, I don't think if they were, I think if they weren't rust colored, he might have survived. So Marty is the only guy who knows where the treasure is, except for that blonde at the bar. But she is like Jake Shapiro mobster guy's girlfriend. So we have two different people kind of knowing where the treasure is. And later, two of Jake Shapiro's henchmen gunned down Marty, who survived, but they actually took the map from him.
Now, you mentioned that the creek where it's buried is only 64 miles long.
That's what Google tells me.
I mean, it has to have been found, right? I mean, you can go there with 200 people and find it.
Yeah, apparently every year people go out on like the anniversary of his death and dig and try and find his treasure, but nobody can find it. But they say that he talked about it, but when I was reading the transcript, the only thing that even comes remotely close to talking about treasure is he goes, "The Baron says these things. I know what I'm doing here with my collection of papers. It isn't worth a nickel to two guys like you or me, but to a collector, it's worth a fortune."
I'm thinking of the ultimate troll, though. And that's to go there and put an X on a thing and bury our own. And when you open it up, it says subscribe to our podcast.
Oh, my God. And like a glitter bomb. Just boom.
A glitter bomb would be awesome. A rust bomb.
Oh, God. No. Now we're getting premeditation.
Yeah, but no. Yeah, exactly. How about a real bomb? No. So.
Oh, God. No. We're joking. This is a parody.
No, but it would be kind of funny to troll people. But I don't know.
Oh,
probably
awesome.
Get shot. With a rusty bullet with my luck.
Well, we jump forward, still in October, but we go to 1992.
Come on, this is a sad one. The two nerdiest people, they're a nerdy couple. It's there's a lot of glasses in this segment.
So many glasses.
Especially in the hotel room. Everybody's got glasses on. So we have Tom Johnson is answering a computer listing that's in the Nashville newspaper. Now, the computer that we're looking, who's the person who is killed? Because I'm forgetting.
Jeremy.
So Jeremy.
Oh, well, Jeremy Rolfs and Heather Ulverman have this computer, but Jeremy just works for the company that is selling it.
Yeah, so he puts an ad in a newspaper. I think we even talked about this a little bit in the past. Back in this period of time, it was not that uncommon to, I think we talked about it when the person was looking for a roommate and, just list your address. And so they're selling a very expensive computer at the time. And I looked it up and it's, you could pick up one of these exact computers kind of working and everything for about less than $1,000, and it's total collectors. It has nothing. It's not usable in the real world. And
now you say less than $1,000, that's in 2021.
That's today. You can go buy it on eBay,
Right.
Back then, they had agreed on $31,000, which was kind of common. This is a video editing machine. This is something that you would, if you went on MTV back in those days, you would do some of that, the special effects with this. It was a Macintosh something 950, Quadra. Quadra 950, because it had four processors. Now, I don't have one of these. To me, this is not on my list of computers that I seek out and find. I really wasn't a big fan of this era of computers, but it is a very, very expensive computer. It's a professional computer. It's the kind of thing you'd find the, it has a big screen for the time back, when the regular screens were 14 inches, why didn't it have a 21 inch? So, so it was a real studio machine. So just to give you an idea of, this thing was literally worth its weight in gold, And $31,000 back then is a lot more than what it is even now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Johnson was like, "I'm going to buy this for $31,000, but I need you to bring it to me in Murrieta, Georgia."
Which I that didn't trigger my red flag yet, personally.
No, me neither. Especially for $31,000, that better come with delivery.
Right. So he throws it into his pretty awesome pickup truck that you would find in Toy Story. And
so he brings Heather Uffelman with him, his fiance, because he just needs some company on the road trip. It's like a 5-hour long trip. So at 1:30 in the morning, they set off for the guy in Murrieta on behalf of the company that Jeremy works for, which is Century City Artists, Inc.
So does that mean, I wasn't so sure about this, is he just a salesperson?
He works there. So it's a music video editing company.
Yeah.
and he works there. But for whatever reason, he's the guy that's in charge of handling this sale. So Jeremy actually talks to Unsolved Mysteries, which is not going to bode well for poor little Heather, but we get him completely in the shadows. We don't see him at all.
But did you notice his glasses are not fitting him properly? I don't know if you noticed that in the no, silhouette. And I'm just going, you know, this might be a little bit of a spoiler, but I have a feeling that he's deformed now from this beating that he got.
I saw pictures of him later in life, and I can say I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
But I think maybe they were like, put these glasses on, see? Nobody will know who you are, because he was obviously trying to go, like, in disguise.
Put a hood on, then, if you really have to.
I mean, I don't know. So he said because the we'll get to that later.
Yes, I jumped ahead, sorry.
No problem. So it's like 7:30 in the morning. They arrive at Tom Johnson's motel in Marietta. And I'm sure you're thinking, but I thought they were supposed to go to his office. So red flag number one, he goes, oh my God, you know what? This industrial park is so hard to get to. Like, why don't you guys just come on over? I'll rent a room in a motel.
Yeah.
And you guys can just meet me there instead. So they're like, okay, sure.
Yeah. And that's kind of like where you and I would go, I don't think so, pal.
No, not because this is basically, like, I know this sounds stupid, but this is basically, like, modern day Craigslist.
Yes.
Like, I'm not meeting anybody in a motel off of Craigslist, which is no, I mean, I'm not judging the victims. They're young. They're so young. So
in their early 20s, right?
Yeah, 19. I think Heather was 19. I think Jeremy's in his 20s. So Johnson says, oh, you know what? My business partner will be by in like 30 to 45 minutes. And he's bringing the check. So I don't actually have the money. And they're like, oh, my God, we've been on the road for so long. We're going to leave and we're going to go get breakfast.
Now, when I saw this at this point, I'm like, oh, my God, it's another check scam like the lady in Las Vegas.
I know, right?
I'm like, wow, yeah. I should have been in on the scam. But no.
Sounds like a way to make some money. Yeah. So they arrive approximately around like 8 a.m. after they've had breakfast. And he's like, TikTok, I don't know what's taking my business partner so long with that $31,000. Like, why don't we just all hang out in the motel room together? And they're like, okay. So they're like laying on the bed, flipping through the TV guide and stuff.
Curtains
and
he's are closed, like, at least in a reenactment.
Yeah. And he goes,
I'd have
oh
that door
God.
Wide open. I'll just stand out here, pal.
Do it in the parking lot. Why'd he even rent a room? So he goes, you know what? I'm sorry this is taking for so long. To save some time, why don't you guys just put the computer in my car now and I'll pay you and my business partner gets here. So they're like, okay, yeah, totally. I believe you. So they help load this $31,000 computer into the guy's car. And you're thinking, okay, the guy's obviously going to drive off with it. Nope. Nope, they all go back to the hotel room and they're just chilling, waiting for like 20 minutes. So Jeremy's like, I've been up for like 30 hours straight.
Yeah.
I would like, do you know where your business partner is? Because I want to get going. And so he's like, I got a gun. So he pulls out the gun, Tom does, and he's like, pull off the sheets of the bed and roll yourselves up in it because I want this to be like easy to clean up. Oof.
The whole thing from this point should have been a regular robbery, right? I mean, this should not have been what it turned into. And it really was disturbing, I thought.
I almost think it wasn't meant to turn into what it turned into. Like, I don't think that's what Tom Johnson intended. So Johnson tells Jeremy, like, look away from Heather. I don't want you looking at her. So he turns away and he says, like, his ears are ringing all of a sudden. It turns out Jeremy has been hit in the head with a hammer. And Jeremy says he sees Johnson hit Heather in the head with a hammer and Heather screams. Now, this is where I got insanely mad. Reenactment Jeremy screams at Heather to stop screaming so Johnson will leave. Basically, like, if
like,
you would just
believe
shut
you're
up.
Dead.
Yeah, but I mean, it was so crazy. He's
no,
like, stop screaming.
The guy's such
leave.
A wimp. Like, you know what? How about this? Get up.
Or,
fight,
you know,
do something, scream, like, I don't know, like, break a window. I you know, you do anything you can to not be in a situation like this.
I mean, he has a gun, you know, to be fair. He's got at least two weapons on him.
Yeah.
So Tom does. So I, and again, they're young, they're trusting, they're from Tennessee, like, they got wide-eyed, like, I just... they were up against a monster, but I just thought it was rude to kind of put that on Heather. Like, oh, stop screaming when you're
no, it was disgusting. It really was. Yeah. It was just one of those, to me, I took it as just let him think you're dead and he'll leave you alone.
Yeah, I can't.
And that's when the bear attacks you and eats you, you know? And
exactly.
I'm, you know, I don't mean to make a joke here, but this poor girl died a very, very horrible death.
Oh, yeah. He just keeps on beating her with a hammer until she stops screaming, basically. So he leaves, Johnson does, and he's wiping his prints off everything as he does. And Jeremy crawls over to Heather, and she is, like, twitching out in the reenactment. Like, it is upsetting to see. So he's like, I'm going to call the police. So they're both rushed to the hospital, but sadly, 2 hours later, she dies from massive skull injuries. And authorities find the hammer, and it's still, like, wrapped in plastic wrap, and it's just got blood all over it, and it has price tags on it. So we find out, oddly, that a woman, and in the reenactment, she had, like, the Georgia-iest accent. It was, like, designing women up in there. But she went into the motel lobby area when the kids were out for breakfast. Jeremy and Heather were out for breakfast. She goes in, and she's like, there's some kind of dispute going on in his motel room. And they're like, ma'am, like, we don't know what you're talking about. She's like, I think it's urgent that you get down there. And they're like, go away, crazy lady. But they basically think now that maybe she was Johnson's accomplice. And when she realized that he was going to kill Heather and Jeremy, that... Yeah, that she tried to foil his plan. So now, sadly, Jeremy has had, like, a very, very sad life. He actually died at the age of 27. He went into the Peace Corps, and he was hit head-on by a driver in South Africa who fell asleep at the wheel.
I mean, this is a guy who escaped death once, and, you know, it's really, I mean, to be killed at 27... having already gone through that, and you join the Peace Corps, you know, and you're trying to do this thing, maybe you had a lot of guilt for just completely not standing up for this poor girl. And yeah,
they were supposed to get married in months away from when this had happened. And he said, like, I couldn't see the places that I used to see with her. Like, he was distraught by it. He was like, I know that this guy's out here still. I can't even change my address legally because I'm scared that this guy will have where my address is and have my public records and stuff. So that's kind of why he was incognito on the Unsolved Mysteries episode.
Yeah, I mean, when this was released, there was no update. So I have to, I understand, I guess I don't understand, but I can't imagine the fear that he would have for this unknown thing, but still trying to talk out about it.
Yeah, oh, totally. I can't imagine what a situation that is because you're trying to do right by Heather and try and avenge her death and stuff. But there is a lot of people online speculating that a computer salesman named Tom Steeples could actually be the killer. So Tom Steeples is a guy who in 1994 murdered newlywed couple Rob and Kelly Phillips in a motel room by bludgeoning them. Sound familiar? Yeah. You know, and we'll post it on the Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Facebook page, but there is a composite sketch of Heather Uffelman's killer next to Phillips, the Phillips's killer, and he looks pretty similar. I could see it.
Yeah, I could see it. I mean, mustache is the only thing that's kind of missing.
Yeah, and he actually committed suicide in jail by, like, purposely overdosing on drugs, and it's just, in my experience reading through this guy's laundry list of crimes, he is a serial rapist. Like, he raped everybody. So I just, Heather wasn't raped. We know that Heather wasn't raped. So I,
maybe the opportunity just wasn't there.
I mean, it's possible. But it was like bludgeoned to death in a motel room is very similar. And he said that he worked for like a music company in Tennessee and he was going to give that guy Rob like a recording contract, I guess. So,
yeah. And I guess he sold the computer. It's one of those type of things, you know, nowadays, if you were to go into like an Apple store and steal something, as soon as you turn it on, it would, you know, the GPS would be triggered and they'd know exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. And with any of the computers and everything, not just GPS, but the IP address. And because each computer has its own like fingerprint, it's called a MAC address. So that's why if like somebody steals your computer right now that you're on, you can actually track it by that address. Cause it's unchanged. You can't change it. It's kind of interesting. Back then though, I guess you could probably sell that computer for like $20,000 to the right person.
Well, Robert Stack left us by saying that the computer has never been reported. Like, there's never been seen of this computer ever again. Like, nobody has ever laid eyes on it. At least that has reported it.
And I've been known to buy some shady, you know, buy stuff that's come to me in a shady way from shady people. So hopefully none of this. I never bought one of these, though. And, but it, you know, falling off the truck. You grow up in New York, things fall off the truck. And
yeah.
As we know from, earlier with Dutch Schultz. So, you know, hopefully one day we can have one of those chests of jewels fall off the truck.
Oh, my God, that'd be awesome. But so we go for the next story a little ways away to Park Springs, Pennsylvania, and it's October 4th, 1988. We have 200 rescue searchers looking for 5-year-old Lauren Jackson. We meet Christina O'Donnell, who's Laura's mother, and who a whole lot of people suspect to be the prime suspect. We also meet Mickey Jackson, who's Lauren's dad. They were never married. They broke up in 1987 when Lauren was 4, and it seems kind of contemptuous. They shared custody of her, but there's no love lost between these two parents.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. They don't seem to have a great dynamic together, but they seem to have an agreement on the child.
Yeah, and, you know, this poor girl was put in some really bad parenting situations. So Lauren lived with her mom mainly, but 1 month before she disappeared, her mom was actually arrested for impersonating a doctor to obtain a prescription for propoxyphene.
And what is that?
It is an opiate.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Which, you know, not great parenting there, obviously. And Mickey, who's her dad, told Lauren because of this that he was going to get custody of her, which, again, not great parenting. Like, why are we putting that on a kid? So according to the mom, Lauren and her oldest daughter got a cheeseburger, and then they came home
played in the dirt.
Yeah,
I didn't like the way that the mom talked about this, because she said that she kept bothering her to get a cheeseburger or something like that. I forget how she said it.
Yeah, but she said all day she was bothering her to get a cheeseburger. So finally she was like, all right, I'll get you a cheeseburger.
It's like, sorry, it's not an opiate.
I mean,
I don't know. It just seems like kind of not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
You know, so she finally went and did it, and they seem to be, you know, they seem fine. They're having lunch or dinner, whatever it is. And they come back, and she goes and plays with the 6-year-old neighbor, Brian, in the dirt. Mm-hmm. It's something that they enjoyed doing. Now, this happened in October, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the action happens here, it's mm-hmm. about 7:15, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been dark at that point? Or I'm just trying to think if it was dark.
That's a good question. I don't know. Probably.
Because I'm trying to think. I know that daylight savings happens at like around Halloween.
Yeah, it's like.
Does it get darker or lighter, though? It gets darker.
Darker.
Huh. All right.
Darker, I think. Good question, though. Yeah, I think that happens around Halloween. This is October 4th. So I think it happens like a month from now. So
I'm just wondering if it's dark at 7:15 in the beginning of October. I guess I can find out. I'm just kind of curious because the place looks like your regular kind of apartment complex. Probably not great lighting. Kids are outside playing in the dark. You know, anybody could just pull up and. Grab your kid.
Numerous people saw them outside playing. So that to me says, yeah, it probably was light-ish, you know. So the mom's like, okay, they got things handled over here. I'm going to go inside and clean. She goes inside to clean for 20 minutes.
Sweeping.
Without
20
checking.
Minutes.
Yeah. Sweeping. She said she was like cleaning the counters and stuff like that. And when she comes back out, Lauren's gone. Like, there are no kids playing. So she goes to Brian, the little boy's apartment, and she's knocking on the door and nobody was home. She later found out that Brian's mom took Brian to the mall and just left Lauren outside. So police chief Jim Cody actually describes the search for her, and police dogs found her scent towards Route 724, which is a quarter mile from her home. And then what they don't tell you on Unsolved Mysteries is that they then found her scent in the parking lot of the Vincent Motel, which is a mile from her home. And that's where the scent stops. So they think that she was put into a car there, whatever's happened. So an 11-year-old eyewitness comes forward and she says that she saw a white man get out of a car, pick Lauren up, like Lauren was just wandering along, and shove her into the car.
Now, where did she say she saw that happen? Do we know?
They don't say where she saw it happen, but in the reenactment, they do it right on 724.
Like, kind of like she got away from these people or something.
Yeah.
And,
exactly. Like, she wandered off, and then a guy saw his opportunity and grabbed her. But interesting. Asking me, motel plus abduction of a little girl screams either sex trafficking or, like, rape and murder to me. Like, just from my amateur detective, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this whole thing kind of screams for a type of sex trafficking or child trafficking type of situation. Mm-hmm. We have another witness who claims to have seen the mother doing kind of a handoff.
So months later, a witness comes forward and she says that at exactly 7 p.m., she saw Christina, quote, give Lauren away, the mom, give the daughter away to a couple in the James Way Mall on October 4th at 1988, which how would you even remember the time and day? So the next day, Police Chief Jim Cody shows up unannounced at Christina's house to kind of lure the mom out. And across the way is like a bunch of FBI agents and the witness. And the witness looks at her and she's like, that's the lady I saw shoving the little girl into the car.
Months ago.
Months ago. And they show the reenactment. It is upsetting because she's like, no, mommy, no, stop. And she's just like shoving this little girl into a car with some random couple. But kids throw tantrums.
Oh, I've been in this with my kid when he hated being put in a car seat. And I remember this one particular time, two parents were like sitting there watching me do this because I'm like, he's literally fighting me. And it's like, I had to punch him. No, I didn't punch him. I had to really, really push him in and hold him down and strap him in. It was like the worst thing in the world. And you can't do anything. I mean, sometimes kids have real, real tantrums. And my kids certainly had a few.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, maybe it was a custody switch off with Mickey, or maybe, you know, like it could have been anything and the girl didn't want to go, or it could have been a totally different family. Like, we don't know. So I personally am going to believe the 11-year-old who instantly went to the police and said what she saw versus this woman who just said months later, oh, yeah, this is what I think.
It's true. And even the mom says later on, it's like, I don't know if this is somebody who's just really kind of just going to the FBI and getting attention. As we know, people do love attention. So,
oh, yeah. And she's like, maybe she saw me on the news or something. Like, I don't know why I looked familiar to her, but she said that she gave her away at 7. But as we know, and you said earlier, Lauren was playing in the complex as late as 7:15. So we actually meet the current police chief, Bill Dembski, who's like, no, I think that witness is mistaken. Lauren's dad actually says that he thinks Christina is involved and did it just to spite him, A, and B, because she couldn't handle the responsibility of raising a kid alone. So they actually bring this to the grand jury, and the grand jury took 4 months before deciding that they were not going to press charges against Christina because there just wasn't evidence to prove that Christina, the mom, actually did anything.
My question is, Lauren's dad says that Christina is involved.
Mm-hmm.
In what exactly? Like, I mean, what is the crime that we're talking about? Abduction, trafficking, selling?
No, he thinks that she gave he thinks that she gave Lauren to her family members in Florida. So he thinks that she's safe and sound and fine, but just to get him away, to get her away from him. Basically.
And Christina's somehow masterminding this all, and the police can't seem to figure it out.
Exactly.
Seems a little bit much.
Well, there's a few girls named Lauren Jackson that actually pop up in Florida that are around the same age and they look similar, but they did like DNA testing. Sadly, none of them were her. And it says update, but we're
just it's not much of an update.
No, they just give us an age progressed photo of what she would look like now, which is important. But Christina O'Donnell died in 2011. I think it's intriguing to think that the mom did this. I think that makes for a juicy story, but I personally don't think Christina had anything to do with it. And can you imagine the grief of losing your child compounded with everyone thinking you did it?
Yeah, and people have, you know, been in situations like this and actually gone to prison for it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really crazy because we can't say. I mean, it's possible she did do something nefarious.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's possible, you know, she got mixed up in the drug thing. She was clearly doing something. She was definitely a shadier person than I think that the show lets on, and mm-hmm. she might have gotten involved in certain things, and this could have been retaliation, which brings us to our next mother-son situation, which is a heartbreaking thing. But I think it's mostly heartbreaking because I think that the motive, just the end result, was over a kind of small amount of money, really.
Yeah, this one is a bummer, so buckle up. We are in Dallas, Texas. It's Wednesday, December 23rd, 1981. At 11:45 a.m., Officer Ray Bayard is patrolling the area 10 miles outside of Dallas, and he sees an abandoned car. Now, he had patrolled this area at 11:07 and saw nothing. And then at 11:45, he sees the car there. And the car is like on the wrong side of the road, and it has a door open, and it was still warm. So he's like, he sees actually women's things in the car. So he figured that there was a woman probably being raped or, you know, hurt somewhere. So
good police work for Roy, you know. Definitely, you know, looking at the signs and calling for backup. You know, it's not like, we hear about sometimes, you know, people doing things like this, officers, and they don't call the backup, and then they end up shot and they're dead. Or
yeah. And the area in the reenactment, that because he goes and he ventures off into the woods, the area in the reenactment was like a wide open field with tons of tree lines like all around. And it was like, if you were going to be a sitting duck anywhere, like that is a bad place to be.
Now, you learned something very interesting about this particular road.
I thought you guys would like this. Now, that road, apparently for decades and decades, way before this happened, is actually an old haunt. Like, people have heard ghost stories, hauntings about this road in particular. Of course, what happens on this road bolsters that, but this is actually in the blog, which I will post a link to. It's called Old Haunted Holloman Road, but they actually said that when they were kids, they were told, like, don't go there. And, like, everyone was like, I bet you can't make it all the way up to the house at the end. Like, it was like a dare among kids.
Yeah. Do you have any roads like that near your house? Not to say that, you know, I don't want you to disclose where you live.
I live on, like, dirt roads. And, like, I am out in the boonies. But I don't have, like, kids being like, I dare you to go up to, you know, old Kim's house and go touch it, you know. I don't, as far yet, as I anyway. Know.
Yeah. With your Halloween decorations that are going to be up 24/7 throughout the year.
Maybe. That's right.
But we have a number of ones that are kind of frightening. And there's one where when you're driving, if you were to put your car in neutral, even though the road is graded up, your car will speed up. And it just has to do with the angle of the road, really. And it's a very weird kind of illusion. And people would say that if you do that and you know, at midnight, that type of thing, and get out and look at the back, you'll find children's handprints all around the back of your car.
Ooh, creepy.
Yeah, because there were legitimately was a school bus crash there back in like the 50s.
Ooh, and kids died. Stories like
cool
that.
Story. Yeah. And there's the lady in white on the same road. A lot of cool stuff on Long Island. We make up a lot of cool stuff.
Well, sadly, speaking about children dying, Roy Baird, the officer, when he walks into this clearing, he sees a crumpled little boy and an adult woman on the ground with a blanket covering her. And they are both dead, and she had been raped. They were actually shot. This is a rough detail.
Yeah, this is the whole thing, just knowing that the child and the woman were both killed. You know, it's the worst thing ever.
Well, when they take autopsies, they find that little Christopher, the boy, his eyes were burned, which means his eyes were open when he was shot. And he was shot so hard, he was knocked out of his shoes. Now, they also know that Roxanne, his mother, the woman laying under the blanket, witnessed that before being raped and killed.
How can they determine that? I mean, the amount of time?
I have no idea how they determined that. They said when they arrived, the bodies were still warm, so maybe it was something about that. I really have no idea how they determined that. But, oh my God, what a horrifying last moments on Earth. I can't think of a worse one. Honestly, that's horrifying. I would rather take Dave Bach's death over this. This is just the worst thing. So Officer Baird gets choked up, like still talking about it. You could see he's like starting to cry on camera. And this is like a Texas police officer. Like, he is
a tough guy. Yeah.
Yeah, so we have the victims are 30-year-old Roxanne Jeeves and 5-year-old son Christopher Corper. It was actually Christopher's 5th birthday.
How do you make it worse, really?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. It's the worst. It's a guttural, like, horrifying story. So from the appearance of the crime scene, they found... Oh, this is what it was. They found... That oh that's it sorry just that she was forced to watch her son's execution. She actually had just moved to Dallas after getting a divorce from Christopher's father. She was an insurance agent. She liked to go clubbing at like the country western bars. She was actually engaged at the time, and she was supposed to be married in 1982. And the morning that they were leaving, they were actually going to visit Kansas for the Christmas holiday, because it's just a few days before Christmas. But before, they were going to actually stop at her future mother-in-law's work, which was a craft food factory in Garland, Texas, to take little Christopher on a birthday tour of the plant.
All of this, like, you know, family time, you're getting ready for this one, you know, wonderful memories.
Mm-hmm. And there's Christmas presents in the back. Yeah, it's just, oh my God. So... we find out that Roxanne told neighbors that she was going on this trip to Kansas, but she wanted to take her toolbox with her because her car was like so unreliable and it might break down.
And I mentioned, I don't know why they need to emphasize this, this kid carrying this toolbox. It just seemed weird to me.
Now, it was seen by a neighbor, and the neighbor comes on in, you know, the police reports and talks about it. So I think that's why we get such a visual of, like, this little 5-year-old. He looked even younger in the reenactment.
Yeah.
But dragging down this huge red toolbox that's, like, as big as him, and he's bringing it down stair by stair. And the neighbor's like, "You want me to help you, Christopher?" And he's like, "I got it." So she's like, "Oh, kids will be kids." And she actually, in real life, has her infant with her. She's taking her infant to the doctor. So she turns around to be like, "Oh, that kid, he's such a cut up." And she sees an either a Native American or Hispanic woman with a black eye and an African American man who, quote, didn't look like they were from around here. Right. And she sees the man grab the toolbox to kind of like help Christopher, and then grabs Christopher by the hand and walks on their merry way. The three of them go and walk off together.
Weirdest part of this reenactment is what you just described.
What? Like, I always say, like, you know, I don't want to blame the victim. I don't want to, but like, why wouldn't she go like, "Huh, that's weird," or like call the police or something? Because she said like they were rough, like they were dirty, they did not like people I knew. They were grabbing this 5-year-old. Like, wouldn't you at least go check with Roxanne and be like, you know, what's going on here, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, like, you know, see something. I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, she had a screaming infant who was probably sick. I'm sure she was like more focused on that. But that's what she sees about 10:30 in the morning. So at about 11 a.m. Roxanne stops to get gas, and add this guy to the list of guys who I'm sure is having some guilt after the fact. But he is, Donald Crawford is like washing her windows at the gas station, and she is just looking at him non-blinkingly, like almost like, "Help me, help me." And he sees an African-American man sitting in the passenger seat next to her, and he's like craned his head so that the gas station attendant can't see him. And Donald's like, "That's kind of weird." But he says that Christopher was just like playing in the back, like nothing was wrong. So he's like, "This might be like a family quabble. I don't know what's going on here." But he goes in and tells his coworker, like, "We're going to see them on the news. Like, if anything happens, it's going to be to them." Can you imagine seeing that? And again, not going to the police. And then something does happen. Like, that's, oh, I'm sure he feels all the guilt.
But you know what? I would imagine that they see stuff like that all the time.
Yeah, and you don't know what goes on in people's, you know, personal life and stuff like that, too.
People,
like,
are constantly arguing in the car.
Yeah. Oh, shit. That's, like, the best place to...
Yeah, it's like, you can't get out. You're stuck with me.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's been plenty of times I've been at a gas station arguing with my husband on a road trip or something, and I don't want to look at him, like, giving him the silent treatment or something, and I'm not being kidnapped, so...
Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, so it's 11:45 now, and that's when Officer Baird discovers the bodies. And when backup officers joined him, the suspect ran away. He's actually seen running by a witness named Tamara, who 22 years later was able to ID him from a photo lineup. So I'm a little
I don't remember much from 22 years ago.
I don't remember much. Like, I don't remember people I see, tomorrow. Look, tomorrow, that's stupid. But you know what I mean? Like, I can't.
I don't remember either. So, yeah, I mean, it is kind of strange, but I don't know. I mean, I guess it's legitimate. Yeah, it's 2 decades, but your memory is that good.
It turns out to be legitimate. So 8 eyewitnesses actually see him like hitchhiking near the crime scene. And when we join our cops, like looking over the car and stuff, they find a blue bag in the car and they believe it's his bag. So they open up the bag and there is an old holster, like a old, like they said pre-World War II holster, a hat, like a beanie kind of, and a bottle of formaldehyde in a lemon extract bottle, like a McCormick's lemon extract filled with formaldehyde.
That's so bizarre. I mean,
yeah,
but yeah, like you were saying, formaldehyde, I think you can just kind of get, I looked it up real quick and you could buy like a quart of it for like $57 online.
Oy, that's crazy. But how you get it in 1981? Like that's bonkers. Well,
but they use it for taxidermy. So, you know, you probably go to a hobby store and get it. I just don't know. I mean, I know that it's a really kind of volatile chemical. I just don't know. And I never heard of this thing that you're probably going to talk about, the Sherman stick.
Yeah, police are like, he was making a Sherman stick, a.k.a. a joint of marijuana laced with formaldehyde. And I asked Jack, my husband, I was like, have you ever heard of like people lacing with formaldehyde? And he's like, oh, you mean a sherm stick?
Oh,
I was
no
like,
way. Oh my God.
I was like, how do you know about that?
Like, Florida.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's never done it, but he was aware of it. And so, yeah, it will mess you up, apparently. So they think he is a heavy drug user because that's not something you stumble into. A Sherman stick is not a gateway drug. So this around noonish, the suspect bursts into a gas station 6 miles away from the crime scene. And he was at the gas station for about an hour, and the gas station attendant was not having any of it.
Like, I love that reenactment. She was like badass.
Yeah, she was like, get out of here. No, you can't use my
phone. There's a payphone right there. I thought he was going to kill her.
Oh, 100%. She was so tough with him.
Yeah.
And so he actually uses the payphone and just loiters around. And he was seen running off towards the interstate. So we get witness Ray Morris, who saw the suspect running down this like embankment towards the interstate. And a 1955 green Buick stops down or stops to let him in. And then they take off, which is like the least inconspicuous vehicle. Right. I mean,
it's not like, yeah, this is not the kind of car that wouldn't be standing out. How hard would it be to find? I mean,
I don't know. And so they think he probably called the guy on the phone and was waiting for that guy to go pick him up. So police get a ton of tips and everyone's saying you need to talk to Roxanne's brother, who is Army Private Kurt Jeeves. Now, Kurt used to live with Roxanne and Christopher, and apparently it was a pretty good thing that he left for the Army because he was kind of a mess. So he used to deal weed and he apparently made some enemies in the drug world. So they recall this story where late at night, a man named Brantley comes storming into her apartment, like banging on the door. Let me in, let me in. She opens the door and this guy comes in and he's like, where's Kurt? Where's Kurt? I need to talk to him. And she's like, he doesn't live here anymore. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, tell Kurt I want my weed back. So apparently Kurt was trying to be a like a lower level drug dealer. And so they gave him like a ton of weed to sell from the higher ups. And he hadn't moved the product, but I don't think he even gave them like their cut of it. So it was a bad situation. And then you got these people coming to a house where there's a 4-year old, you know, and Roxanne, who didn't sign on for any of this. So police think maybe she was targeted by those people in an attempt to get back at Kurt.
I'm going to see. Probably this is a fact. This is what makes sense to me with this entire thing. Doesn't seem to you?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But
I just think that it really seems like, you know, it just seems so targeted. But you go on.
No, I'm interested to discuss that more, but we'll put all the cards out on the table. So 2 years later, actually, Kurt was murdered at age 25 while trying to buy drugs. He had been shipped to Germany with the Army, and he had been dishonorably discharged. He was actually held in the brigade in a Louisville brigade, and he got discharged from there, went to go buy some drugs, flashed a big roll of bills to the wrong people, and was shot right then and there.
Right. He seems like a real jerk.
Well, the parents of these people lost their son, their daughter, and their grandchild in 2 years.
It's crazy.
I can't imagine. That's horrifying. So we do have an update. In 1984, George Washington Hicks pleads guilty to an unrelated charge of sexual assault, and he is sentenced to 15 years. He serves some time, he gets paroled, and in 1993, he rapes a woman who is just trying to buy formula for her three-week-old baby.
Yeah, this is, he's like a real gem. I mean, he's the type of guy who, it's just so strange to me how people can go to prison and then come out, and it's just like, goes, you go right back to this behavior.
Yeah, and in 1994, he is actually sentenced to 80 years in prison for that sexual assault and for a robbery. So in 2001, Detective Larry Forsythe, who is on the Unsolved Mysteries, had DNA testing done on a hair that was in the beanie or the cap. And in 2003, DNA identified George Washington Hicks as the killer. Now, in 2007, he is convicted of the rape and the murder of Roxanne, and he is sentenced to life. And in 2014, he is convicted of the murder of Christopher. So he is actually sentenced to life again. And they spaced it out. There's 7 years difference between these charges, but they spaced it out so that they would guarantee that he is not seeing the outside again.
Now, why do you think that he was not involved on some level with the drug dealers?
Well, the reason why is because he likes to rape women when they are preoccupied with their child and their child's safety. You know, like talk about the 3 week old child, the lady's trying to go buy formula. He attacks her. He rapes her. He has sexual assault on his case before. I think that this is like clear escalation of sexual assault. Then we got rape. Then we got rape and murder. And I think, again, when it's a woman who has a child, she is more preoccupied with their safety, and she's probably more likely to put up less of a fight to ensure the child's safety.
Sure.
You know, I don't know. So I think that this guy is a scumbag, but I don't personally think he was related to the Kurt thing.
I don't know. I just see him as being the kind of derelict that you would call upon to, I mean, if it really depends. I mean, it depends on the amount of money involved, I guess. It's something we're just not really sure of. It's a possibility that that was really having nothing to do with it. There was no evidence to support what I'm saying. But so you think it was a random attack?
I personally think it was a random attack. But like you said, it's this guy. You know, this guy is the guy you would call if you wanted to do something like this.
Yeah.
I just, you know, if it was like to go rough up Kurt or something, I would see that more than like, oh, go rape and murder his sister and murder his nephew. Like, I'm sure people do that.
Yeah.
But just with this guy's past history and stuff, I personally don't see it, but there's nothing to say that it was just a random attack either. Like, that's just both of our gut feelings. Yeah. There's no real evidence pointing to one or the other. At least he's sentenced away and will die in prison.
Like, so he's alive currently and he's doing his time.
Yeah, and he actually won't begin to even serve the sentence for these murders until 2024 because he's still on for the rape of the woman who was trying to get baby formula. So he actually isn't serving time for like these particular ones, but he has so many life sentences like back to back to back. If one were to be exonerated for whatever reason, like he would still be in prison for life.
Yeah, I mean, he's currently 69 years old.
And it's a rough 69. It's a 69 that looks like you've been smoking Sherman sticks. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how good his health is, you know, but.
Well, his projected release date, believe it or not, is January 1st, 1999. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather he. Yeah. I mean, of course, we'd rather the children live and him not. Yeah. But it's good that he'll never, ever be a free person again.
Yeah, absolutely. This guy obviously. We'll just keep doing it. So that was a heavy note to end on, but I hope that we did it some justice.
Yeah, we have to learn. It's funny. We sometimes talk about like, should we end on a happier note? But there's really not much of a happy note here.
Mm-mm. No. Yeah.
This is a tough episode.
That's all Mystery's fault. That's not our fault.
No, we're just following their plan. But Kim, thank you so much for getting together and doing all of your wonderful deep dives. It's always such an eye opener to have these discussions with you.
The pleasure's all mine. I love talking about these with you.
And if you enjoy this podcast, please visit us over on Facebook, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. Just do a search and subscribe to the podcast.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.